I can't bring to this table the experiences of many of the people at this panel. I'm not Polish or Lithuanian, and I've only visited this part of the world a few times. But I can bring something, and hopefully it will be of constructive value to everybody here. Closer? Is that okay? First of all, I just wanted to thank Christoph and the Foundation for inviting me to come here and to address you. I appreciate that very much. I wanted to, first of all, address you, Christoph. I may have misunderstood you yesterday, but I had the impression that you thought I suggested by something I said that it was methods that somehow or other, when I was speaking, you had the impression that I said methods were the only thing that should be discussed, not other things at this meeting. That's not quite what I meant. Quite to the contrary, I think this kind of dialogue is quite valuable. What I was trying to suggest was two things. One, that there is a need for linguistic clarity in terms of our discussions so that we know what we're talking about when we talk even to each other or to others. And there is possibly a way of doing that through exploring methodology, through some of the things that you and your group have developed, which could be very useful tools towards developing that linguistic precision. That's what I was trying to get at. I was asked to give great consideration to the title of my paper. Then I discovered when I got here in the program it doesn't exist anywhere. But I wanted to mention it because it's important to one thing that I want to say by way of introduction. The title that I conjured up was The Borderland from Afar, Culture as Peacemaker, Embodied Dialogue, and Kultura's Ghost. The notion of borderland from afar is not simply a reference to the fact that my home is a long way from Sene, but it is. It's also a reference to how little I really know about the Foundation. Unlike many of you here who've been deeply engaged with the Foundation's mission or work for some considerable time, my only claim to standing here, or sitting as this is the case, are an interest in aspects of Polish theatre that led me to the Foundation. Several visits to Sinai and an article I wrote about what I encountered in the village that absolutely fascinated me when I visited. So I'm somewhere between a researcher, a novice, and a convert, convinced that the Foundation's mission and its means of realizing that mission are truly of great importance. So with your indulgence, a novice would like to reflect. I first came to the Borderlands work when I attended the performance of the Sinai Chronicles at La Mama in New York in 2008. I'd never heard of the organisation, but being a good theatre professor, I'm on the mailing list of La Mama, and I received a brochure about the Borderlands Foundation and its upcoming production at the theatre. Like many before me, I was fascinated by what I witnessed on stage. The set piece, the centerpiece, the young actors, the songs. They did a production of the Sinai Chronicles. I was so taken by the show that I, in fact, stopped afterwards, waited afterwards, and Christoph happened to be there. And so I introduced myself and we spoke. And at his invitation, I attended some of the other events that were being organized in conjunction with the performance. I went to a film event that showed some of the work that's done here. And I also attended a Cafe Europa event that was done in a local venue that's famous for poetry readings. I became quite intrigued. So within 12 months, I called up Christoph and I came to visit Sene and the Foundation. I wanted to see the centre and find out more about its home and its work for myself. Needless to say, during my visit, I became even more interested and my stay became a journey of research. A journey I'm in many ways still travelling, as I continue to explore the relationship between aspects of Jerzy Grotowski's work and a broader paradigm of the connections between performance, embodiment and cognition. But these are not really pertinent to this particular meeting, so one aspect of that work will become so. Being a good researcher, when I was invited, I immediately got on the website, got on Google, and started exploring a few things. And one of the things I came across was an interesting website, which Leszek will know and so will Christoph, called the Animus website. And there it says that the Borderland Foundation believes that by understanding our neighbours, our past, our present, or present, we can learn how to coexist peacefully and relate to each other. This suggests at least two things to me. One, that respect for cultural, ethnic, and or national difference is critical, and that one's own culture, ethnicity, or nationality are aspects of identity to be celebrated, not subverted in the name of political correctness. This aspect of the Borderlands mission is obvious to so many of its initiatives, through many of its initiatives, which I won't list because I'm sure most of you are aware of them. However, when I visited here the first time, a young lady was assigned who works in the Borderland Publishing Division. Her name is Yolanta. Many of you will know her. She was assigned to look after me, to take care of me, because she spoke English, I'm guessing, is why she got that job. And when she met me, she explained to me that she was actually Lithuanian. And she suggested, why don't we take a quick trip into Lithuania? Which is what she promptly did. She put me in a car and off we went across to Lithuania. She said it's very simple to get there. So we drove across. We drove, I'm not sure how long, but a period of time, and all we saw were trees. And we turned around and left. Later in the journey, the same journey, she's still showing me around, she suggested a visit to her parents' home in a village not far from Sene. In doing so, she explained that I'd meet her mother, her father, and more importantly, that I would see a real Lithuanian home, which she indicated is quite different from a Polish home. I'm familiar with neither. Quite apart from a nice cup of tea or coffee, I don't really recall what I had it to drink at the time. What I were told were typical Lithuanian cookies and cake and a very pleasant company. I was struck most by the fact that this young lady who worked for the Borderland Foundation was a confirmation of the organization's ethical premise. That is, that the basis of their entire project, having pride in one's own cultural identity while respecting the identity of the others, was literally embodied in this woman. Now, and what might seem odd, since it's a minor own anecdote in many other things, when I was invited to make this presentation, I kept coming back to this simple personal anecdotal story. It was somehow a touchstone of sorts for me and a catalyst to my thinking about Borderland and the Borderland Foundation's work. It prompted me much thinking, much of which formulated into basically two questions. One, what is the Foundation's genealogy and how has that genealogy shaped its endeavours? And what's the connection between the creative and the Foundation's goals? The Borderland Foundation has grown from the ambitions of its founders, which as many of you know, especially if you've just recently seen the photographs in the building next door, they all came here in a cart, pulled by a horse. This was 22 years ago, and look where we are. It's quite different. At the time, its resources were meagre. Its plans to help alleviate the historic ethno-national tensions among the various cultural groups that continued to or inhabited the region were grandiose. Most everyone's familiar, as I referred to before, with what's developed since then. But where did the initiatives come from? How was it that four people who had no experience or formal training, as far as I know, of resolving ethno-cultural conflict, and who had no contacts with NGOs or others in the field who were developing a body of work towards this end. How on earth did this actually happen? Despite the concerns with borders and the sites of meetings, conflicts and negotiations among the others that they suggested, the genealogy, it seems to me, actually lies in Poland itself. I would suggest that there are two basic components that have fed this genealogy. One of them is theatre, and the other one is publishing. Some of you may be well aware that Krzysztof was a member of one of Poland's leading alternative theatre companies, Gardzianice. He was there from 1978 to 1983, and it was here that he first met another member of the company, who eventually became his wife, Morgazata. And together, they were the co-founders of the Borderland Foundation. Gardzianice was begun, as again, I'm sure a number of you know, by Wojciech Staniewski, a former colleague of Jerzy Grotowski's in 1976. Grotowski, hang on a second, I'm getting very confused here. Let me pause for a second. Gardzianice began by Staniewski, a former colleague of Jerzy Grotowski's in 1976, represents Krzyzewski's theatrical formation. Since prior to joining the group, his performance experience was limited to the inventive, though non-professional, student theatre movement in Poland. Staniewski was a product of the same, though a little earlier. Grotowski invited the future leader of Gardzianice to join his company and participate in his evolving paratheatrical experiments. Staniewski subsequently played quite a leading role in those experiments for about 5 years. And significantly, this was the period of the latter's active culture research, in which Grotowski moved out of the theatre to conduct performance-based experiments that removed the barrier between the performer and the spectator. Grotowski's concept of active culture was largely grew out of his disenchantment with the conventional theatrical structure of the performer and the passive spectator relationship. It was his conviction, based on his years of theatre research and a long-time fascination with Indian philosophy and ritual practice in different cultures, that performance had the potential to move beyond the aesthetic frame into the realm of personal, ontological exploration and what, for want of a better word, might be termed the spiritual. This conviction, consistent with his attempts to recapture the power of ritual in early theatrical practice, discarded the actor-spectator divide and embraced instead a performance practice that involved all participants equally. Following his initial paratheatrical work, which is very, very clearly documented by Professor Colin Kevich in his comprehensive study on the road to active culture, Grotowski's research delved into ever more refined and focused study of performance-based research until his death in 1999. And most of the literature, at least in English, is based on that work. There's even more, there's very little written, at least in English, on documenting the legacy of active culture. And I think that legacy has been extremely important to this organisation and other places in Poland as well, but particularly to this organisation. There's not a whole lot of documentation either on Staniewski's role in working with Grotowski. We have somebody here who can maybe fill that in a little bit more detail. But one thing is pretty clear. He took an instrumental role. We do have that much information, that he was very involved in it, selecting people, understanding the way in which the system worked. We have film footage actually of him running a workshop. And there's quite a fair bit of evidence that he was quite involved involved in that. Now, Grotowski and Staniewski eventually went their separate ways in 76, and the latter continued his research outside the theatre, that's Grotowski, and the former returned to his theatrical roots. But Grotowski's influence was evident in Staniewski's early journey with his recently formed company, Gardzianice. And among these influences were a concept of theatre taking place outside of four walls of a conventional theatre building, a blurring of the lines between performer and spectator, and an endorsement of the actual active culture emphasis on inclusive creativity. Staniewski moved to eastern Poland, near the city of Lublin, which again many of you here would know, when he abandoned his work with Grotowski, and began almost immediately exploring theatrical work amongst the outlying villages and in the region. This eventually became the work that's known as gatherings and expeditions, where he would go to various villages, travel between villages, show some of the work that the company was working on, have a barter type of situation in which the local people would then in turn show their work, and then sometimes they would even develop work collectively and present it in the villages. Christoph was very involved in a lot of this early work. And as members of Gardenizi during that time, the legacy of this experience quite literally travelled with him and his colleagues from their former base in Western Poland. Christoph and his wife eventually left Gardenizi, went back to Poznan, formed their own company, and the two other people who began this company with them were in that company, Arca, and that company, Arca, moved across to where we are today in the horse and cart. And I discovered today that was actually another cart being pulled by a jeep, which I didn't know at the time. In doing that trip, they did very much what they had been exposed to with Staniewski. They travelled from village to village. They did certain performances. And when they arrived here in Siena, they arrived as a theatre troupe. And in fact, they used some of those strategies to initially reach out to the various village people around here and started performing and doing things very similar to what they had done before. But they soon discovered that their ambitions call for broader strategies. The latter developed gradually over time, and these are the side of things that you're very aware of that they're doing now. But all of this was informed to a greater or lesser extent, or at least I would argue, by the ideas traced through Staniewski back to Grotowski and this notion of active culture. The foundation's iteration of these ideas are evident in the collective engagement strategies that at the heart of many of their activities. Likewise, its application of the creative as a catalyst for change. Its belief that active involvement rather than passive witness by participants in the activities it organises is vital to helping change develop ingrained socio-cultural attitudes. And the fusion of the creative and tolerance in education as a means of realising a pluralistic community devoid, or at least watered-down version, of ethno-national tensions. Now, I want to also look at some of the publishing component of this of the contribution. Now, contrary to what some might think, and this might be a little bit controversial in this particular setting, despite his importance and both symbolic and real to the entire Borderland project, I don't believe that Czesław Miłosz played as important a role in the genealogical development of Borderland as a man called Jerzy Giedroycz and his Kultura Press. Many of the Polish people here would certainly know who I'm talking about, though he's dead now. He died in 2000. Giedroycz, I'm going to give a bit of information on who Giedroycz was because not everybody in the room might know. Giedroycz, a former political bureaucrat and journalist who grew up in a Polonized Lithuanian family in Minsk and various parts of Russia before attending law school in Warsaw, published the first issue of Kultura in 1947 in Paris. In 1953, he expanded his publication list to include the Kultura Library series that produced volumes of literature as well as books on political topics and memoirs. The journal and library series, with their focus firmly on its founder's homeland and native language, were published continuously till 2000 when he died. Following its appearance in 1947, Kultura quickly became the focal point of the Polish emigre community as it published literary works, political essays, as well as critiques of ideas and Polish literature by what were to become the leading Polish writers of the time. These writers include internationally known figures like Miłosz, Szymborska, Jan Kott, and all the leading leading literary figures of the period. And it was widely read despite the fact that it was published in Poland, it was widely read in Poland itself, despite the fact that it was so banned, it was passed around clandestinely. Under Giedroycz's leadership, Kultura championed the principles of political equality for all, social justice as well as respect for human rights, and the dignity of each and every citizen, no matter their ethnic origins, through the distribution of clandestine copies inside Poland, it became a rallying point for ideas during three Polish uprisings in 56, 1970, and 1980. It opposed the Polish emigre government's call for the restoration of Poland's pre-war borders and was among the first to formulate what became a cornerstone of Poland's post-communist East European policy, the renunciation of territorial claims on Eastern European neighbours, and the recognition of Lithuania, the Ukraine and Belarus as independent nations. Giedroyc and Kultura provided an inspiration for the work of Krzyzewski and his colleagues. The political values espoused in both Kultura and the library series of books, a bold ambition for literature and commentary that demanded the attention of Poland's intellectual elite, a list of contributors who has shaped 20th century Polish letters and thinking, and above all, the vision of an inclusive, secular Polish nationalism championed by Giedroyc was very much in keeping with the nascent organization committed to ethno-national harmony. The fact that Krzysztof, a product of the university student movement under late communism that spawned much of Poland's multidisciplinary, alternative literary, intellectual art and theatre movement, was an aspiring poet and essay himself, as well as an actor, further enhanced Kultura's importance of what was to become the Borderland Foundation. Given Krzysztof's literary ambitions, it's hardly surprising that Giedroyc's example has also suggested a model for the foundation's strategy of collective engagement, most directed at a wide Polish-speaking audience, its publication wing. The foundation's journal, Krosna Gruda, and its various book series reflect the balance between a periodical and books Giedroyc established at Kultura. As with Kultura, the target audience is clear, since virtually all of the foundation's publications are in Polish, and it's consistent with its aim of educating Poles about their neighbours. The Meridian series includes, among its titles, numerous translations of Eastern and Central European authors. And the Sine Almanac, meanwhile, is a fusion of the expansive ambitions of a Giedroyc and the understanding of how important the local is in promoting acceptance and change that's central to the Borderlands Foundation's aims. I want to suggest out of that a taxonomy of, without discussing it too much at length, this has been long enough and I don't want to discuss too much. I want to discuss something else, but this I want to keep relatively short. I want to suggest a taxonomy of that are several clear influences of the foundation's theatrical and publishing genealogy that are critical to its subsequent history. One is the need to reshape the narrative of cultural acceptance, the importance of a local focus, and with connected to that is the whole notion of memory and restoration, particularly as it speaks to the Jewish community and the work that's been done here with that. The use of creative practice as a tool of education, the role of a cultural animator, that is, those who use culture in order to engage rather than merely entertain a public. A long-term educative process, this is long-term. There's nothing involved in the work here or in the work of either that was done in the theatre or in Kultura that is short-term. It's not immediate impact. It's something that's developed over a long period of time. Six, a commitment to an embodied engagement process of learning, and that's key, embodied engagement practice, especially with young people. You've seen lots of examples of it. I'll talk about that in a little bit. I want to spend just a very, hopefully, brief time talking about the Sinai Chronicles and some of the work done there, because I think it feeds into all of the ways this work feeds into the creative work that's so fundamental to everything that I think that the foundation does. I won't describe the Chronicles. Most of you have either seen it or are going to see it. It's going to be on a little later this week. It's an incredibly successful production done with young people from the village. It's been done now, at least when I saw it in 2008, it was in its third iteration of one group of teenagers teaching another group of teenagers and so forth. What is really important, it's a very moving production. That does not even need saying for anyone who's actually, you know, had the good fortune of seeing it. But what's much more important, I think, about the production is how it was created, because I think there is a really important lesson to be learned, an understanding about methodology and the way in which the foundation works. I'm just trying to find the right spot because I'm cutting pieces as I go. Okay. The production evolved from a 1998 exhibition, Our Good Old Seine, mounted at the Foundation Centre in Seine. I think, if I'm not mistaken, some of the photographs that are in the Foundation are actually still from that period. The exhibition consisted of postcards and photographs from the Centre's archive. The documented material was one of the things that's key to this material in the exhibition was the fact that it was collected by children. Some of it came from the archive, but some of it was collected by children. The public showing of this material prompted a competition of creative responses to Sinai's history and yielded many art and literary works, again, by children. In conjunction with this competition, the eventual director of the production, Schroeder, in her role as head of the Children's Documentation Archive and Children's Theatre Studio, had the children gather oral histories from their parents and grandparents. These anecdotes were then compiled into an individual mini-histories and family trees that were used to shape a partially true, partially mythical plan of the town's past and that incorporated matching the stories and legends they'd heard to specific sites. During this process, the children whose family roots were drawn from most of the various ethnic and national groups in the region learned each other's songs. They also learned the songs of former residents who are no longer here, the Jews, the Roma. And as part of this process, Schroeder encouraged the children to recreate the village, which has become the centrepiece of the production, in baked clay models. And then eventually they developed the production. Now, what I think is really interesting about this process is the way in which there is an implicit acceptance that one of the ways to learn about the borderland situation, in fact, I think it's actually a process of learning in anything, but it's been particularly successful here, is to have a process of embodied learning, of actually doing something as well as learning about it. We happen to be just sitting here listening. Lots of people have left. Some people are sitting chatting to each other. Many of us are very tired. It happens to anybody. It's normal. But if you engage someone in practice as well as engage them cognitively, their learning quotient goes through the roof. You saw a perfect example of it this morning, those of you who were here watching the people perform the music. These people were performing the music. They had spent a long time learning their instrument, learning what the particular songs they had to play, learning how to play those well. And that learning process, that movement into the body, I would argue, is as much part of the process of what's involved in the Borderlands methodology as anything else. And I think it's vitally important to understand in relation to the importance that culture can play, not just the world of ideas, not just the world of diplomacy, but that culture can play in change, in negotiating this whole idea of the border. This combination of embodied learning and cultural expression is really indicative of a whole range of work, I think, that this organisation does. Some of you will have seen me fiddling with pieces of paper and everything before I came in, and I want to just show some of the stuff I was working on. Excuse the rudimentary diagrams. I'm not a graphic artist at all. But I would argue that the Borderlands work actually falls along a continuum, a line between which there are two ends. One is education, and the other is embodied cultural practice. And the educational end is probably, if you took any one of their initiatives, I would argue that they fall somewhere along here. Now, for instance, what we're doing today, which is much closer to the idea of the Agora model, would fall much closer directly to the educational component. But where would you put something like the Sinai Chronicles? It's clearly not just embodied cultural practice, because there's a huge educational component attached to it as well. So it's somewhere in between the two. And virtually every one of the initiatives that the organization has fall somewhere along this continuum, because there is this component of the two elements involved in what they're doing. No, that's to everybody else.
I just want to know what you would classify as something that's off that continuum.
Do you want to discuss that at the end? Yeah, no, but I think it's important to ask it at the end, because I want to finish what I'm saying for everybody else. The combination of cultural practice and education taps into what the 2004 RAND Corporation report, The Gift of the Muse, Reframing the Debate About the Benefits of the Arts, terms the intrinsic benefits of the arts, which is authors identify under three categories. One is private benefits, namely engagement, captivity, and pleasure. Private benefits with public spillover, expanded capacity for empathy, for example, cognitive growth, learning. And public benefits, the creation of social bonds, expression of communal meaning. These are studies, this is a RAND study I'm quoting, which has explored this kind of, not specifically this work, because actually their work has been based in the United States and Canada. But I'd argue that all of this is clearly evident in the work that you're seeing there. And these methods provide the opportunity for further benefit, because they promote dialogue. These whole things promote dialogue between different ethnocultural groups. And this dialogue is both verbal and embodied. For example, if you're sketching something and you're drawing the synagogue, you're actually doing something in relation to learning about the other. If you sing the songs of another, if you happen to be Polish and you're learning a Yiddish song or a Roma song, you're engaged in something. You're not necessarily just being told about it. You're actually doing something. And this fits in very much to a study that was done by the Ford Foundation. This just helps inform what I'm trying to talk about. This is being rushed, of course, because I'm aware we're running late on time. The 2000 to 2004 Ford Foundation funded a project called the Civil Dialogue, Arts and Culture. And it points out that what dialogue does in particular settings such as this, it allows assumptions to be aired, which I thought was very interestingly done at this table today. It creates a platform of equality. Each one is equal. Each one gets their say. Everyone has to listen. And it develops a greater understanding of others' viewpoints through empathy, if one is prepared to listen. As the anecdote of the Lithuanian experience I talked about at the beginning of this presentation alluded to, the Foundation works with societies proud of their pluralistic tradition. It's conscious that as a result of ethnic and religious diversification, potential threats of igniting new conflict still exist. But most importantly, it believes that with initiatives such as theirs, we can learn how to coexist peacefully and relate to each other. Now, earlier in the meetings, there have been a lot of metaphors thrown around to do with borderland relating to a physical space, referring to a personal space, referring to a regional space. There's been ideas, Professor Gross suggested the idea of no borders at all. And I wanted to suggest, in closing, a visual metaphor for what I think is really happening in this kind of setting. Again, you're going to see nasty graphics. And this speaks to the notion of, very much to the notion of linguistic precision. This is my poor attempt to put in visual terms the intercultural. There are actually two cultures involved in this particular image. You can't see either of them, because in the true intercultural world, one is taken over by the other, is taken over by the other. So it becomes one single culture. These are very simplistic, but they're trying to get a point across. If you have a multicultural world, I put a border around it, but probably the border shouldn't exist. In multiculturalism, there is no contact between the cultures. You have the cultures quite separated, but within the same space. Large cities are very frequently like this. It's somewhat of an idealistic model. But I think this is the kind of model that you actually have here, which is what they're... And I think it's a very realistic model, and I don't think it has anything to do with just a borderland in the true sense, where you have... I'll just use these as examples. There are three cultures that I've just taken to highlight. One in blue, one in red, one in green. If you'll notice, what I've done is picked out where these cross over just the one other culture. In other words, where you have blue and red, or where you have green and blue. Now, again, these are simplistic, but it's an attempt to explain what I think goes on. And you have this very tiny portion in the middle in which all three of them actually meet, contact, and really work with each other. And I think this is closest to the model of what you're dealing with in something like the borderland situation. And it's a model that never stops. It's not a static model. It's a one that constantly needs to be addressed, constantly needs to work with in what you're doing. And I just want to wrap up very, very quickly, if I can find the right piece of paper. Okay. We were asked to look at what do I see from the borderland, or what does the borderland going to do tomorrow? Well, personally, I'm no expert in this, but I thought of two things that I thought are very interesting. One is that I think these methodologies that are here are really a basis for growing and building upon. But I think there is a danger, which was touched on by Morgrazata earlier, yesterday I think it was, where I think it's really important with the development of something like the Krosnogruda Center that the local, the national, and the international is in some way balanced, because I think there's a real danger that with that organization developing what I've heard some of the plans are, that it could become far more focused internationally rather than locally and nationally. And I think that something has to be ensured that doesn't develop. A balance is important. And another thing I thought of is I think it would be very interesting if there was some way in which this kind of work could be incorporated into the university system or some kind of connection developed where there were people who are not just trained as cultural animators in the general sense, but are specifically trained as conflict resolvers, people who can deal and work with those kind of issues. There's a very interesting model in Wroclaw, which is actually an artistic model. It has nothing to do with this work. The company in English is called the Goat Song. Many of you would know it. I don't know its name in Polish, but it's really known by a Polish name because it's a very famous Polish company. Works with the University of Manchester, and they have an MA program. It's in acting. And they, every 2 years, bring a cohort of students across to Poland who are from that university, and they work closely with the university, with the people at the university in doing this. They bring these people across and they spend 6 months at with the company, the Goat Song. Part of that time is spent in training in the studio with the company. And then the two people who founded Goat Song were actually long-time members of Gardzenice. They then go and take them on an expedition out into the countryside. And they work with the local communities in terms of developing and working on. And out of that, these students get a master's degree in combination with coursework that's done at the university. And I think something like that could be a very interesting model to consider, which would broaden the work and bring, I think, some very interesting young people into the work who are not necessarily just of the local community, but the local community could feed into that. Thank you very much for your patience.